Welcome. This is Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, an online Bible study with Dr. Joel S. Baden.
Welcome, everybody. Nice to see everybody back again, and those who are still coming in. I'm going to get started by sharing my screen. And can I get a nod confirming that I've got a nice title page there for everybody? Thank you. Awesome. I love it when the technology works. Okay. So, where are we in our story? We haven't gone anywhere. We are exactly where we were before. We are in the middle of a book-long, essentially, speech by God from the tabernacle at the foot of Mount Sinai. And yet, even though in the story world, basically nothing has changed. In fact, you know, Leviticus 16 is a divine speech. And then Leviticus 17 is another one, and they seem completely fluid one to the next. Scholars tend, and I'm one of them, to make a distinction between what we see in Leviticus 1 through 16, which we talked about last week, with this incredibly enclosed and thought out priestly sacrificial system. Distinguish between that and between chapters 17 through 26, which follow. To give you the general sense, the idea is that what we read last time, the sacrificial stuff, is for the most part, as I think we said in the conversation, a unified priestly understanding of the sanctuary and impurity and sin and how that all works, and that what we have in these chapters for today is a later sort of layer that's been added on to that original priestly material. And there are, I think, a few broad ways in which we can see that something has shifted from the first half of Leviticus to the second. Again, what we read last time, Leviticus 1 through 16, is really narrowly focused on the sanctuary itself. You may recall me saying something like, these chapters really don't care about you. They care about the sanctuary. So we've got this very narrow focus for the first half. When you get into this half, suddenly it's like, oh, but we do care about you a little bit. It's a broader sense in these chapters of what the concerns are. Actual people matter. Not just cultic stuff matters, but in these chapters, we get a sense of, oh, like morality, behavior, ethics, along with some of the sacrificial and cultic stuff that's maybe a little bit less interesting. But in these chapters, we're certainly broadening our scope to include things beyond just the world of the sanctuary. Maybe three ways that are significant in which this material in the second half goes beyond the material in the first. So one of those is the definition and really insistence on the notion of holiness in these chapters. You will have noticed, perhaps, that we get this regularly repeated refrain in the second half of Leviticus. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Is sort of comes again and again and again. Again, if you think back to what we talked about last time, you shall be holy is not really a thing that you could have imagined in the original priestly system, right? Holy is the things that belong to the deity. Here, suddenly, we have the idea that, maybe holiness is accessible, at least, even optimistically accessible for everybody. Lots of different things, the holiness suddenly is beyond just the realm of the sanctuary. And in fact, it's this repeated refrain about you shall be holy that has given, in the scholarly world, given these chapters their name. Whereas we talk about the priestly material, often P, in the first half, here we have what's called the holiness material, which we talk about using the letter H. So P in the first half, H here in the second half, which is not to say that it's not still priestly. Right? As you can tell from the content, there's still an enormous concern with priestly sacrificial kinds of stuff. Think of this as like the next generation of the priestly school of thought. It's not a gigantic shift of any kind, but it is something slightly different, slightly broader. So holiness, that is one way we see that. A second way we see that shift is in the way that the notion of impurity is used. Again, remember that in the first half, in P, impurity is this totally normal standard thing. Everybody is impure plenty of the time. It's not a big deal. It's totally fine. All you have to do is take a bath for the most part and wash your clothes. And it's fine. It's only really a problem if you need to go to the sanctuary, which is where impurity is forbidden. In these chapters, suddenly all kinds of stuff is impure that wasn't impure before. Behaviors are impurifying in different ways. Impurity spreads and infects different kinds of places, which we'll come back to. So there's, along with holiness, impurity has shifted too. So last time I talked about the two binaries of holy and profane and pure and impure. Suddenly those are not looking quite so clean cut in these chapters anymore. And impurity starts to become a language that's associated with immorality in a way that it certainly never is in the first chapters and in the earlier conception of this stuff. And the third area where we really see a difference is in, again, broadening from the concern with the sanctuary in the first chapters. Suddenly the land is much more important here, not just the small area of the sanctuary and the temple kind of environs, but the entire land of Israel is now at stake. And we'll see this come back again. But again, mostly again, what we're seeing here is what was a very narrow concern is suddenly being broadened out to apply to different walks of life, to different areas physically and conceptually. But it's building on, it's like, it's sort of it's the yes, what you said in those chapters, but also I think more. And I'll talk as we go along about some of the ways I think that reveals itself and some of the ways that it matters. All of these themes that I was just talking about, holiness and purity and land, they're all embedded in these chapters still in legal discourse, right? We're still reading what feels just a bunch of laws. It's a lot less ritual. It's not, you know, here's how you sprinkle the blood, but it's still legal and on a really a much wider variety of topics than we saw in the first half. You know, if you read through these chapters before meeting today, you know, you will have been probably just a little bit shaken and confused by just, it's all over the place. Chapter follows chapter with no seeming rhyme or reason in terms of sort of logical progression. It's kind of a grab bag of extra stuff. But I'll sort of give an analogy that makes sense of that in a little bit. I want to mention right from the beginning, and I'll come back to it in a bit, but right from the beginning, these chapters are, again, even if most people don't know most of what's in them, most everybody knows one of the most famous sentences in the entire Bible, which is found in here, which is the golden rule, right? Love your fellow as yourself, love your neighbor as yourself, depending on your translation. And obviously enormously famous. It's the one of the only verses in the Bible that's got a pithy name like the golden rule. It's a passage that in both Christian and Jewish tradition is highlighted as essentially one of the core features of the text. So if you're reading the Gospels, I happen to pick this one from Mark, but it's also in Matthew and Luke. You know, we have this sort of like little story of the scribes coming to Jesus and saying, which commandment is the first of them all? And Jesus says, right, well, the first is Hear, O Israel, right? What's known in Judaism as the Shema. And the second one is love your neighbor as yourself. Those are the top two. So here we have, you know, Jesus affirming the golden rule as special. That's a story that I assume most of you are familiar with. Here's the Jewish version of it from the Talmud. We have a Gentile who comes before one of the rabbinic sages, Shammai, and says, I'm happy to convert to Judaism, but you have to teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one foot. Shammai is like, I don't have time for this, and pushes him over. At which point Hillel, who is Shammai's great rival and one of the great sages, one of the great historical figures in Judaism, the guy comes to Hillel and says the same thing, standing on one foot, teach me the whole Torah. And Hillel goes, if you don't like something, don't do it to somebody else. That's the whole thing. right? Everything else is commentary. Go and learn, which is a beloved passage, I think, in Judaism. But again, for our purposes, is making the point that the golden rule, we think of that way because our Jewish and Christian traditions have highlighted it for us. My guess is that if we gave you a Bible with no familiarity with it, the chances of you somehow finding this one verse like needle in a haystack would be relatively small. My point actually there being, we call it the golden rule and we circle it in our Bibles and we make a big deal out of it. But within the Bible itself, structurally, it's not marked in some way. It's not like it's in bold or underlined or in like bigger letters somehow. It's one single verse in this whole sort of package of laws that we have in these chapters. Like I said, I will come back to it in a moment. I do want to take a minute and look at some of, well, not a minute. I want to take the rest of our time here to look at some of the other laws in what's called this holiness material in the back end of Leviticus. Because you know, hidden among here, and I'm sure actually many of you found them and know where they are, hidden among here are some really important passages and some really problematic, troubling, relevant laws. And I'm gonna spend most of my time on what I think are the big ones, with maybe a detour here or there. I'm gonna start with Leviticus 18 and 20. I'm really just going to do 18 because Leviticus 20 is essentially a parallel to 18, almost identical in content. And what we have in Leviticus 18 and 20 is what's commonly known as sort of the sex laws, basically who you can and can't have sex with and how. And virtually all of them, and I just picked one at random here, virtually all of these laws are relatively reasonable by our contemporary standards as well. Mostly it's, don't have sex with your family members. My suggestion, just as a sort of passing comment, is that the rationale behind these laws may be less, it's a moral affront, and more that when you have sex with family members, issues of paternity and inheritance get confused very quickly in a way that the Bible is really consistently careful about not letting happen. I've said this in other contexts, but there's constant, enormous concern with making sure, because inheritance is, you know, patrilineal, we need to know who the parent of any, parentage is really deeply important. If families start getting interwoven in these ways, it becomes pretty confusing. In any case, the family-based sex laws, I think, are relatively straightforward. It's worth noting, I didn't pull this one up, but one of them says, you know, you can't sleep with a woman and with her sister, which, again, is not like a totally unreasonable, like, ethical principle, except that, of course, we have cases like, I don't know, Jacob, who a couple of books earlier does exactly this. Which is a reminder, probably, that we're not always reading the same authors when we're reading the Bible, and that different authors can have completely different takes on what is and isn't appropriate, and perhaps when in history things were and weren't appropriate. So after the family laws, we get, still within the same chapters, we get a slightly different set of laws that seem to be picking up some of the same themes. So we start, first of all, you shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness, which is this chapter's sort of euphemism for sex, while she is in her menstrual uncleanness. Okay, like on its own, that wouldn't be such a strange thing. But here I want to point out that this is a different concept from what we have in the first half. In the first half of Leviticus, in the P section, it doesn't say you can't approach. I mean, it says that you will become impure if you have contact with a menstruating woman. It doesn't say not to, it just says you do, and then you take a bath. But here we're already seeing, right, a little bit of a distance from what's in the first half. Here, okay, no, you're not allowed to. We're forbidding it. There's evidently impurity is now something that is increasingly something we want to avoid rather than simply a fact of life. You shall not have sexual relations with your kinsman's wife. Okay. Yes. Adultery. Bad. Fair enough. Notice though, and defile yourself with her. Again, sex is naturally defiling according to the first half of Leviticus, according to the P material. But this suggests that, you know, it's a particular kind of defilement, like a moral defilement that comes with adultery, which again, broadening our sense of what impurity is. This is this, if defilement here is the same word as impurity. Okay, so menstruant, adultery, and then just sort of thrown in for fun, no child sacrifice. Here using a biblical expression about not giving your children to sacrifice them to Molech, who is sort of a shadowy kind of deity in the ancient Near East and in the Bible. But in any case, the euphemism of, you know, give your offspring to Molech is to sacrifice them, even if you're sacrificing them in attempting to do it to Yahweh, to Israel's God. Okay, no child sacrifice. That's not a sex law. That has nothing to do with sex. So I'm not here to solve that problem. I will simply call out the slightly odd placement of it. But I'll also call out, for whatever it's worth, the fact that if people weren't sacrificing children, at least sometimes, you probably wouldn't have to say this. Now you might say, so what are you telling me, that like all the adultery, all the sex laws are also, yeah, the answer is probably yes. But for sure, I mean, there's actually plenty of evidence both within the Bible and from archaeology that child sacrifice, even if not a common thing, was a known practice. And this author wants nothing to do with it. Even though, for example, if you were to read the book of Judges and you get to the story of Jephthah sacrificing his daughter to Israel's God without anybody complaining about it much, you'd recognize that this author's particular antipathy toward child sacrifice may not be as widespread and as universal as we might think. After this comes really like the big one here. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. This is still to this day and age, in fact, probably more in this day and age than ever before. This is the verse that justifies anti-gay views and arguments from the kinds of people who make them while holding up a Bible, right? This one's easy, right? This is the one you see on like posters held by the people who hold posters. Lots of folks try to soften this, right? They try to say, it doesn't really mean homosexuality is wrong. Okay, yes, this one particular sex act is forbidden, but they're not saying anything more broad than that, which may be true. But in part, that's because they didn't have a concept of sexuality and gender identity and sexual preference, and like homosexuality wasn't the category as such. So the act that they're describing here, that's the thing that existed for them. My point here is to say, the Bible very clearly, to my mind, prohibits at least homosexual male intercourse. If you want to make it narrower than that, if you want to broaden it from that, it's prohibited. And there's nothing, there's really almost nothing we can do to say, yeah, but maybe it meant something different. This is one of those cases where we have to say it's in there, right? It's in the text. And our job is not to take it out of the text. It's to say, okay, now what do we do once it's there? I'm not going to answer that question. I'm just going to put it out there. The last law in this section is no bestiality. Again, fair enough. Before we move on, I want to think about, we've got all of these sex laws and the child sacrifice stuff, and I want to think about the rationale, the framework for these laws, for all of them, including the family sex laws. The rationale for Israel not doing it that's given in the text is not just this is morally bad. It's not just God said no. The rationale at the beginning, before the laws, is You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt, where you used to live, and as they do in the land of Canaan, where you're about to live. In other words, and then we get all these things that you're not allowed to do. The idea from the text is, we don't do these things because the Egyptians and the Canaanites do these things. And like, that's, you know, they're bad. And those people who do them are you know, gross, and we want nothing to do with it. Now, we know historically that this is not at all the case, right? The Egyptians and the Canaanites weren't, you know, committing all of these, you know, all these like sex law violations or sacrificing their children more than anybody else. What we're seeing here is not a historical truth, but rather a rhetorical move. It's interesting, of course, Israel is surrounded by lots of various countries, right? Not just the Egyptians and the Canaanites, but the Arameans and the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Edomites. And the Ammonites and the Edomites and the Moabites and the Arameans are all in Genesis said to be related to Israel, right? They're all associated with the, you know, cousins and brothers and nephews and stuff. All of Israel's surrounding people, except for the Egyptians and the Canaanites, they are not related to Israel. That much is very, very clear in Genesis. And instead, what we hear about them is this, right? They're awful. They're terrible. They're morally corrupt in all of these various ways. And my sense of this is, they had a narrative about themselves coming out of Exodus, coming out of Egypt. And there's a concern about their origins, right? We're not the Egyptian. We want to make so clear that we are not Egyptian, lest anyone think that we are just because, you know, we came from there and our big leader guy is named Moses, which is an Egyptian name. We're not Egyptian. And also the Bible is super concerned with saying we are not Canaanites, even though we know archaeologically, historically, that they really were, right? Israelites are just Canaanites who sort of got up and moved to a different part of the country. So what I think we're seeing here is a kind of demonizing of the people that we used to be, just to make really clear what our identity is, right? We are, this is Israel defining itself against against the places where it narratively and historically came from. All that said, the material here is really awful. Like, this is an awful thing to say about another country. And there was a time when I couldn't even think of a particularly good contemporary parallel to this, but I wasn't trying very hard. But now, today, I'm like, oh, what does it remind me of to have Israel saying, oh, our enemies over there, these guys, right? Like these guys, oh, they have sex with children, right? And they have sex with their family members, and they slaughter children, right? It's QAnon, right? It's like literally the exact thing that like the conspiracy theorists today are saying about, I guess, just Democrats. And that to me says a lot about kind of the power of these particular kinds of you know, offenses that you can slander someone with. This is about as bad as it can get. After we get this, so this comes before the sex laws is don't do it like this. And then after we get this material, don't defile yourselves in any of these ways, okay? Because it's because of all of these practices that the nations I'm casting out before you defiled themselves, right? You can't do this. The Canaanites did this. Why do you think I'm kicking them out of the land so that you can have it? Which is actually a really interesting perspective on the thing. It's not like it's as if the Canaanites had just been cool and not done these things. Where would Israel go? Nobody knows. But the story is, at least the story this text is telling, is the Canaanites were immoral and corrupt. And as a result, they defiled themselves and they defiled the land. The land became defiled and the land vomited out its inhabitants. And so now it's going to be empty for you. What's interesting here is the idea that there's a kind of that moral impurity, right? If cultic impurity defiles the sanctuary, moral impurity defiles the land. And conceptually, the issue here is we have a whole mechanism for purifying the sanctuary when it gets too dirty, right? We have all the sacrifices. The land has no such mechanism for purification. Moral crimes corrupt and defile the land, and it just gets worse and worse and worse until not God leaves, right? Which is what happens when the sanctuary becomes too dirty, but you have to leave, right? The land spews you out. And so indeed, it goes on, don't commit any of these abominations, otherwise the land will vomit you out for defiling it, just like it vomited out the people before you. So I just want to point out, we've got sort of a logical outgrowth from the narrow sanctuary focus of P into this this broader moral focus and land focus of the H material. Okay. For P, the real threat was God might leave and we'll be at the mercy of others. H seems to really have in mind, like, it's not God leaving that's the real threat. It's us having to leave. In other words, exile, right? Exile is the looming threat for this material, which doesn't mean that it was written in or after the exile. It just means it may have been written by people who were more conscious of the fact that exile was a legitimate sort of outcome of you know, the geopolitical situation, as it were. Okay, sandwiched between Leviticus 18 and 20, these two parallel panels of mostly sex laws, is Leviticus 19, which is itself like a total hodgepodge grab bag of laws. Yes, it has the golden rule in it, but it also has laws like, you know, you can't let your animals breed with a different kind of animal. You can't sow your field with two kinds of seed. You can't put a garment on that's made of two different materials. So, you know, the Jews all know this, but, you know, for those of you who don't, right, all of your lovely polyester cotton blends are right out the window, right? We're not gonna have any of those anymore. So, like, this kind of very random technical ticky-tack kind of law is right there alongside, mixed in with the golden rule. You can't eat fruit from a tree less than 3 years old. Okay, you can't get a tattoo. Okay, you can't eat sacrificial meat that's been sitting out for 3 days. Fine, right? These are all, my point is, these are all laws that are contained in the same, very same chapter as the Golden Rule. And in terms of structure and sort of textual time spent on them, they all get the same attention, right? There's this verse here about not mixing your animals and your seeds and your clothes is a verse of the Bible in the same chapter as that other verse of the Bible that says, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. I just want a nice point. Anyway, here also, we do find the golden rule. Here it is again. I do want to spend I'm going to take like half a minute on this, just to point out, we look at this and we're like, this is the greatest rule of all. It's, you know, this is the wonderful care for everybody kind of law. But I want to ask a question of definition, which is, who is the fellow? Who is the neighbor in the golden rule? Love your neighbor or your fellow as yourself. And I simply want to suggest that we read that in a universal sense, and no ancient Israelite would have read that in a universal sense, right? Your neighbor, your fellow, is an Israelite. Right? So this is not about everybody on earth is, you know, worthy of et cetera, et cetera. This is about your fellow Israelite. So just, you know, keep it. It's a lovely rule. It's not as perfectly wonderful as you might like it to be. At the same time, it also doesn't stand alone. Later on in the same chapter, we get love the stranger as yourself. Right? Same exact wording, same phrasing. Instead of love your neighbor as yourself, that is your fellow Israelite, love the stranger as yourself, the non-Israelite. Awesome. Didn't we? So that's it. We've covered everybody. We haven't covered everybody because strangers are still people who are dwelling in Israel alongside Israelites, right? They're part of the community. What this verse doesn't say is love anybody who doesn't live in Israel as yourself. So again, lovely rule. We have made wonderful things out of it. It's always worth recognizing sort of where the text or the ancient mind might have said, like, are you love everybody? I mean, did you hear me what I just said about the Egyptians? Do you mean them? Probably not. Briefly, Leviticus 23 is a festival calendar. It goes through all the major festivals of the year. And is that a fascinating thing on its own terms? I don't know, maybe not. But it is the fullest such calendar in the Bible. And it's the basis for these days, like all of the Jewish holidays and all the Christian holidays that were stolen from the Jewish holidays. Did I say stolen? I meant stolen. Good time to remember, I think, that the holidays that we think of as even as biblical holidays weren't always like performed, practiced in one particular way. They developed over time. So I'm just going to take a second to look at Passover as an example. The earliest calendars we have in the Bible mention really only three festivals at all. But when they're talking about what we think of as Passover, it says something like this, right? You shall observe the festival of unleavened bread and eat unleavened bread for 7 days. Great. It doesn't call it Passover. It just talks about the unleavened bread. And it doesn't mention anything about the Exodus story because it's not about the Exodus story. In the early stages, this festival, like the others, it was an agricultural festival. Israelites were farmers and they celebrated, you know, the harvest and the planting and the sowing. And I don't know what all those words mean technically, but the stages of agricultural development. So the first step, it was agricultural and it was really just about the grain, in this case, the unleavened bread. I'm not going to read this whole thing, but Deuteronomy comes along and is like, yeah, okay, but we're all going to celebrate in at least the same place. Instead of in your local sanctuaries, we're all going to celebrate at in a centralized location and at probably in the same time of year. We're all going to observe this in the month of Aviv, which basically just means spring. And in Deuteronomy, you'll see, makes reference to the Exodus because that's when God brought you out of Egypt. And Deuteronomy mentions not just the unleavened bread, but Passover. You shall offer the Passover sacrifice and you must eat unleavened bread for 7 days. So Deuteronomy is sort of putting together the pieces into the holiday that we know. But you'll notice that it just says in the month of Aviv, right? Like sometime in the spring when it makes sense. And then we come to our text of Leviticus 23 in our calendar. And now we have dates. In the first month, on the 14th day, at twilight, that's when there's going to be a Passover. On the 15th day, we start the unleavened bread thing. So again, just to point out that, right, even within the Bible, we see development of the festivals over space and time and through various authors. In this calendar, we also find, well timed for the season we're in right now, the first reference to Rosh Hashanah. It's not called Rosh Hashanah, but it is. At the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you're going to observe a day of complete rest, and we're going to blow some trumpets, right? That's the shofar, and that's Rosh Hashanah. This is the first time it appears anywhere in the Bible. And of course, along with it comes Yom Kippur. And the 10th day of the seventh month is the Day of Atonement. Yom Kippur, we call it Yom HaKippurim in the Bible. It shall be a holy convocation for you. Great. I want to take this moment to go back briefly to Leviticus 16, which is, I mean, when we read about the protocols for Yom Kippur. For the Day of Atonement, because this gives us an opportunity to see how a festival develops even within like one chapter of the text, even within just layers of the priestly writings, right? From the priestly material, from the P, the earlier stuff, to H, the later stuff. Back in Leviticus 16, this whole ritual that we have of purifying the entire sanctuary, right, from the inside out, right, and getting rid of all of the sins and all of the impurities and even the intentional sins that we put on the scapegoat, when did this ritual take place? Well, at the beginning of the text, it says, right, God spoke to Moses after the deaths of Aaron's sons and said to Moses, tell Aaron he can't come in here into this Holy of Holies, the inner sanctuary, anytime he wants to. Here's how he should do it, which is funny because you'd think it would say like, he can't come in anytime. He can only come in once a year, but it doesn't. In the original P conception of this ritual, it didn't happen at a set time. It happened whenever. Whenever the high priest thought, or maybe the community thought, we need to clean up the sanctuary. Like we need to do our regular cleaning now. We need to do our deep clean has to happen now. Maybe it's like when things were going particularly badly for Israel and they thought to themselves, man, God must be like on the verge of leaving. This is what what it must, the sort of rocky stuff we're going through. Let's go clean out the sanctuary to make sure that we're doing everything we can. And I'll point out the reference to Aaron's sons at the beginning in this case may not be a mistake, right? That's a moment when in the sanctuary itself, sin was committed, death occurred. It's possible that the text is signaling to us with that reference. This is the kind of time that might make sense to do, maybe. But the idea was that the whole ritual was ad hoc. When it's needed, here's how you do it. And then on to the end of the chapter, we get this added to it. This will be a statute to you forever. In the seventh month, on the 10th day of the month, which you may recognize as the precise calendar if we just read, you shall do no work, neither the citizen nor the alien. So it's not ad hoc. Now it's formalized. I've got a date for it, which is it's a safeguard of sorts, to be sure. Now, if you know you're going to clean every fall, right, your annual fall cleaning, then you know it's never going to get so bad. But it also kind of robs the ritual of some of its force, I think, as a response to things going badly in the world. And you'll notice the way that this section talks about how atonement or purification works. On this day, atonement will be made for you to cleanse you. Right? Remember, that's not how the priestly system works. The priestly system is you bring the sacrifice to cleanse the sanctuary, to purify the sanctuary. Now you're having sacrifices done to cleanse you, right? You will be clean of your sins before the Lord. Again, so this is one of these little, if you understand the way the priestly system works, you can see that this stuff, though building on it, is not quite right. It's a different view. And then we have the introduction of audience participation, as it were, right? You guys have to deny yourselves, right? You have to fast. Why do you have to fast? Because there's a ritual going on in the temple that's cleansing you, right? You have to participate somehow, but of course, all of Israel can't be in the sanctuary at one time. So you fast to mark that, yes, this is happening to me on my behalf. In the original priestly concept, you didn't need to fast, right? The priest was just in there doing some sprinkling blood around. It had nothing to do with you. I wanted to use the festival calendar as a way of seeing that the Bible isn't a static document. This section, this H section, is they're constitutional amendments, right? Updating the text to match the changing ideas and circumstances of ancient Israelites. I also like to use this to remind us that what's written here in all of this material in Leviticus isn't necessarily ancient Israelite practice, which I sort of said last time. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, right, which we now think of as the most important holidays in the Jewish year, exist in the Bible only in these chapters, only in Leviticus does anybody, and I guess in Numbers once, only in these this little priestly world do those holidays even exist. Nobody else knows that they exist. So what we're seeing in this text isn't ancient Israel changing its beliefs and practices. We're looking at the literary expression of an ongoing conversation within one small priestly community. And it took on force in the real world only when the Bible or when the Torah became authoritative. And only for those people, even only for those subset of Jews for whom the Torah became authoritative. We don't need to think of this as soon as it was written, everyone in Israel and ever thereafter said, well, this is what we're doing. It takes time. Okay, last major topic. And I'm going to focus in on it because I come back to this all the time. This is for me one of the most important things in the entirety of biblical studies and biblical teaching, and that's the slavery laws in Leviticus 25, which are framed in a broader discussion about land and property. This is where we get the law of the Jubilee year. It's not just a release from debts, but a literal return of the land, even land that's been sold. In the 50th year, all land returns to its original family ownership. And this is because conceptually, the land belongs to God. You don't really own it. God just granted it to you. So when you sell it, you can't really sell it. God decides who lives where. right? Which tribes, which clans, even down to the family. And that's the backdrop for what happens, as the text gets into, what happens when an Israelite goes into debt? That's the real topic here. I'm going to start at the end, which is where we find the underlying rationale for all of this material. Just like with the land, you can't buy or sell or own, really, another Israelite. Right? Why? Because like the land of Israel itself, the Israelite people belong to God. You can't buy an Israelite, right? It wasn't somebody else. You can't sell an Israelite. It's not yours to sell, right? They belong to God. I'd say that this is a different view of redemption from Egypt than we usually have. But we should remember that the word redeem in Hebrew, as in English, doesn't mean set free. Redeeming means to reclaim possession of something, right? And that's how it's used in the Bible as well, even in Leviticus in the next chapter, or two chapters on. If you dedicate your house to God, you say, I'm giving my house to God. What you really mean is, I actually want to just give God the value of my house, like in cash. You have to redeem it, right? You pay the sanctuary the value of your house and you get the thing back. When God redeems Israel from Egypt, that's not releasing them to be free forever into the world. It's God claiming ownership, right? You, Pharaoh, can't have them. They're mine. God is claiming ownership of Israelites. And ownership of humans has a name: slavery. And that's why God can say, the people of Israel are my slaves. Right? They're my slaves. Your Bible, when you look at it, is going to say servants here. They all do. Right? For me, the people of Israel are servants. Right? That's fundamentally wrong. It doesn't even make sense. Right? In discussion about selling and buying people, like among Israelites, to say, you can't do that because they're my servants. It only conceptually makes sense. It's only logical if they're slaves. They're owned property of God. Right? That's why you can't buy or sell them. So, in other circumstances, I tend to go off on the translation of slave versus servant. I won't do that here, but this is one of these places where it really makes a difference. Okay. With this as the rationale, you can't, right? God owns Israelites as God's slaves. Let's look at how debt works. The setup is this: an Israelite goes into debt and sells himself to you. He owes you money, and you want him to work for you until the debt is paid off. That's like actually all totally fine and logical enough. So that's the setup. An Israelite goes into debt, wants to sell and sells himself to you. Now, the rules about how this goes. First, and crucially, you shall not make them serve as slaves. That's what the NRSV has. I don't like it. The JPS translation is better. Do not subject him to the treatment of a slave. What the Hebrew really has here is a remarkable sort of tripling of the word slave. Literally, do not enslave him with the slavery of a slave. What does that mean? I don't know. Or we don't know yet, but the definition's coming. First, we have to get through what it doesn't mean. He shall, the person who is not treated like a slave, he shall remain with you as a hired or bound laborer. He shall serve only until the Jubilee year. Okay, so a slave is therefore different in kind from a hired or bound laborer. And I don't like the translation bound laborer. It's really just a word for immigrant laborer. They're not bound in any way. I think that's just a mistranslation. In any case, but these are two categories of people who work by choice, right? You hire them, you pay them. They're clearly not slaves. That's how you're supposed to treat Israelite debt slaves, as if they kind of had a choice, right? The way that you would treat somebody who you just were paying to do the work. And obviously they go back home in the Jubilee year. You can't keep them for the reason we saw already. They're God's slaves. They have to be released the same way the land has to be released. And then we get the key line. You shall not rule over him ruthlessly. Okay, so if it says don't treat him like a slave and says don't rule over him ruthlessly, the logic there is slaves are to be treated ruthlessly, or at least can be. And indeed, this word ruthlessly, some of you may have heard me say this before, this word ruthlessly appears in the Pentateuch only one other place, This is the very same word for how the Egyptians treat the Israelites back at the beginning of the book of Exodus. In other words, this ruthless treatment is like the paradigm of slavery. So obviously you shouldn't do that with your Israelite debt slaves, especially because they're not really your slaves anyway. Okay, great. Israelite debt slaves are categorically distinct from like slave slaves. So what's a slave slave? Some people will tell you, and by people I mean largely fundamentalist apologists, will tell you that the Bible represents a morally advanced document, right? Because other people out there had bad slavery, but Israel had only the good kind. Did you see? Like, just this debt slavery we're just looking at with, you know, they had released in the Jubilee and treated well and, you know, sent back to their family, right? Israel had the good kind of slavery. Everyone else had bad. But those people who say that simply didn't read on to the next parts of this section. Yes, Israel had debt slavery. And yes, the Israelite debt slaves were treated relatively well. But Israel also had slavery, what we'd call chattel slavery, like in the American South. Such male and female slaves as you may have, and remembering, for this text, Israelite debtors are explicitly defined not as slaves. So we're not talking about Israelites, we're talking about, right, the kind of slaves that aren't the ones you treat well. If you're going to have slaves, if Israelites can't be them, they by definition have to be not Israelites. So indeed, it is from the nations around you that you may acquire male and female slaves. Israelites are enslaved to God and they have to be treated well because they're not your slaves. You don't own them. Foreigners? Fair game. Now, what's imagined here is almost certainly military captives, which is where most slaves in the ancient world came from, cross-culturally, Mesopotamia, Greek, Rome, all of them. But if a resident alien, a stranger, decides to sell you one of their children, that's okay too. Why? Because they're still not Israelites, right? You can't take them by force, right? Because we are told over and over in the Bible how well we are to treat the stranger. You can't take them by force, but if they choose to sell you their kid, that's okay. Here's the part that hurts. These shall become your property. That's human beings as property, openly. You may keep them as a possession for your children after you, for them to inherit as property for all time. There is no jubilee here, year for them. There is no redemption. They are property. They are to be passed down, inherited, owned. These, the text tells us, these you may enslave. And in case we were unclear, a reminder. Among Israelites, no one shall rule another ruthlessly. Right? Again, that's that word for abusive, like physically abusive slavery. And again, the logic is straightforward. Israelites, not ruthlessly. Foreign slaves, go for it. Which is to say, Israel is invited to treat its own slaves as badly, as ruthlessly, as they themselves were treated in Egypt. And in the world of the story, these are the very same Israelites who just left that treatment. So the laws of Leviticus 17 through 26, I keep saying that, 17 through 20, I know there's a 27th chapter. I just never think about it. Isn't that weird? It's like, I never think about that chapter at all. The laws of 17 through 27, there we go, may contain the golden rule. Sure. But they also contain the law forbidding homosexual intercourse. And at much greater length and clarity, they contain the law permitting the possession and abusive treatment of chattel foreign slavery, slaves. And we might say, as Jesus did and as Hillel did, yeah, but the golden rule trumps all else. But that's us saying that. Not the Bible. That's us, for all the best reasons, choosing the verse that we like over against the ones that we don't. And once we start playing that game, we're really just opening ourselves up to the possibility that someone else will choose a different verse to be the one that holds the master interpretive key, and maybe not one that's as nice as the golden rule. I'm not saying that we should somehow be following both the golden rule and these awful, terrible texts. Instead, I'm saying that we should be open about recognizing how our own values not only influence how we read, but are in fact prioritized above what we read. But we can also recognize that the biblical text itself recognizes that values change. That's actually the entire story of these chapters. They are an amendment, right, to a previously existing authoritative text. The Bible is really nothing other than a record of how ideas and values develop and differ within communities, across communities, through space and time. It's okay not to like parts of it. The biblical authors and texts themselves didn't like parts of it. And in that light, it's perfectly biblical to challenge and refute and revise when necessary.
Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week for session 3.